For those of you that might have missed one or two, I'll recap like I typically do to kind of bring us all to where we are in this series, and then we'll jump right in and hopefully roll right through this. This is the fifth of six sessions that we've been looking at the book of Revelation. We started off by giving kind of an overview of how we were going to approach the book, specifically by spending some time thinking about how we weren't going to approach the book. If you were here that day, we took Hal Lindsey as kind of our target of the day and contrasted the way he and what I would call kind of popular evangelicalism approaches the book of Revelation and thinking about these things in general with the approach that we are going to take. And in the next two sessions, we kind of hashed out a little bit more of that approach. The second session, we talked a lot about the symbolic nature of Revelation and why it's important to understand how symbolism works in the book. In the third session, we spent a lot of time thinking about the Old Testament, and particularly the use of the Old Testament and the kind of presuppositional way of thinking about how the Old Testament influenced Revelation. And last time, we took a very quick, very high-level sprint through the book in general, laying out how it all kind of fit together and what it was really all about. We had handouts last week. If you didn't get them, I don't think we have any more here, but they are online. If you go to the church's website where these recordings are posted, you'll find the PDF link there that you can download and review. That really, in my mind, was the heart of the class, what we did last time. That was really the bones and the heart of the substance. So if you don't have that handout or you didn't attend that one, I would highly encourage you to do that. Today, fifth out of six, we're focusing on the theology and goal of Revelation. And then next week, if you remember, we were hopefully going to spend some time answering your questions. I've been asking throughout that you write up some questions and either hand them to me in paper or email them, and we'll get to those hopefully next week. That allows me to prepare a little bit more. I've said from the outset that I'm no expert in this, so I didn't want to just field questions out of the blue. I wanted some time to prepare. So today, theology and goal of Revelation. What this means is that we're going to explore the key themes or ideas that were central to John in his writing of the book. We're going to seek to draw out what was important to him and let his emphases guide us. And all the while, we're going to consider the place of Revelation in the unfolding story of the Bible in general. What this does not mean is that this is not the time for our own questions, to let those guide us. That's what we hope to do next time, as I said. And I will say, for those of you that haven't turned in any questions, if you have them, get them to me today, either here in person or by email for the end of the day. I've got to cut off the line somewhere, so I chose today. So please, get me questions. We have plenty of time, plenty of questions for next time. Today is also not a typical systematic theology, where topics are addressed without reference to the broader biblical narrative. We'll be sticking to the story, so to speak, here, and really working on this from a biblical theology perspective. Our purpose is not to do a deep dive into the theology of Revelation. We just don't have the time. But we want to provide a surface treatment of the most important aspects of John's biblical theology. I think that we will see when we're all said and done that although Revelation is certainly quite different in style, in substance, it falls very squarely in the center of the New Testament when it comes to both priorities and topics. It's not that different after all. And we're going to end our time today back where we started and again look at the importance of the symbolic, parabolic communication that's found in Revelation and what it says about the spiritual state of the church, even in New Testament times. So let us dive right into the key theological themes of Revelation. The first one is suffering and victory. I'll take it as an example, chapter 11, if you want to read along. We'll start off in verse 4. These are the two witnesses. Although we haven't talked about this a lot, the two witnesses are basically the church. They're symbolic for the church. Chapter 11, verse 4. These are the two olive trees and the two lampstands that stand before the Lord of the earth. And if anyone would harm them, fire pours from their mouths and consumes their foes. If anyone would harm them, this is how he is doomed to be killed. They have the power to shut the sky that no rain may fall during the days of their prophesying. And they have the power over the waters to turn them into blood and to strike the earth with every kind of plague as often as they desire. And when they have finished their testimony, the beast that rises from the bottomless pit will make war on them and conquer them and kill them. And their dead bodies will lie in the street of the great city that symbolically is called Sodom in Egypt, where their Lord was crucified. For 3.5 days, some from the peoples and tribes and languages and nations will gaze at their dead bodies and refuse to let them be placed in a tomb. And those who dwell on the earth will rejoice over them and make merry and exchange presents, because these two prophets had been a torment to those who dwell on the earth. But after the 3.5 days, a breath of life from God entered them, and they stood up on their feet, and great fear fell on those who saw them. Then they heard a loud voice from heaven saying to them, "Come up here." And they went up to heaven in a cloud, and their enemies watched them. And at that hour, there was a great earthquake, and 1/10 of the city fell. 7,000 people were killed in the earthquake, and the rest were terrified and gave glory to the God of heaven. As in John's gospel, so also in Revelation, the death and defeat of Jesus are, in reality, his victory over Satan. The Lamb's followers are to replicate the model of his ironic victory in their own lives by enduring through tribulation the reign of, while they reign in the invisible kingdom of the Messiah now. Though the Christian's outer body is vulnerable to persecution and suffering, God has promised to protect the regenerated inner spirits of the true saints. And at the end of the sojourn of Christ's body, which is the church, on earth, its presence, like his, will be completely removed, and it will be resurrected. Conversely, when the church's opponents persecute God's people, they spiritually defeat themselves in the same manner that Satan was defeated at the cross, though it appeared that he had won a physical victory over Christ. Acts of oppression against the saints, when not repented of, lay an increasing foundation for the oppressor's final judgment. And even themselves become expressions of judgment by hardening of these folks who are permanently recalcitrant. The main rhetorical goal of the literary argument of Revelation is to exhort God's people to remain faithful to the call to follow the Lamb's paradoxical example and to not compromise, all with the goal of inheriting final salvation. That's what this book is about. But it's not the most significant idea in the book, however. As we talked a lot about last time, the main theme is the glory of God, the glory due to God for that matter, because he has accomplished full salvation and final judgment. Even the notion of Christ and the church reigning, ironically, in the midst of suffering, and the idea of unbelieving persecutors experiencing spiritual defeat in the midst of their physical victories, even these things demonstrate the wisdom of God and point accordingly to his glory. Suffering and victory, a theme that runs throughout the book. Another theme, key theme, is that of the throne. Look at chapter 4. "After this I looked, and behold, a door standing open in heaven. And the first voice which I heard speaking to me like a trumpet said, 'Come up here, and I will show you what must take place after this.' At once I was in the Spirit, and behold, a throne stood in heaven, with one seated on the throne. And he who sat had the appearance of jasper and carnelian, and round the throne was a rainbow that had the appearance of an emerald. Round the throne were 24 thrones, and seated on the thrones were 24 elders, clothed in white garments, with golden crowns on their heads. From the throne came flashes of lightning and rumblings and peals of thunder. And before the throne were burning 7 torches of fire, which are the 7 spirits of God. And before the throne there was, as it were, a sea of glass like crystal. And around the throne, on each side of the throne, are 4 living creatures full of eyes in front and behind. The first living creature like a lion, the second living creature like an ox, the third living creature with the face of a man, and the 4th living creature like an eagle in flight. And the 4 living creatures, each of them with 6 wings, are full of eyes all around and within. And day and night they never cease to say, 'Holy, holy, holy is the Lord God Almighty, who was and is and is to come. And whenever the living creatures give glory and honor and thanks to him who is seated on the throne, who lives forever and ever, the 24 elders fall down before him who is seated on the throne and worship him who lives forever and ever. They cast their crowns before the throne, saying, "Worthy are you, our Lord and God, to receive glory and honor and power, for you created all things, and by your will they existed and were created." There are 17 references to God's throne in chapter 4 and 5, if we were to continue on, of 34 total references in the book. That's a lot. These serve to underscore the centrality of God's sovereignty, for which he is ultimately given glory. God and Christ are glorified because Christ's resurrection demonstrates that they are sovereign over creation to judge and to redeem. The clear deduction from chapters 4 and 5 is that the Lamb is in the same divine position as God, which is a point reiterated throughout the remainder of the book and intimated earlier. Chapters 4 and 5 introduce and overshadow all the visions in chapters 6 through 22, which flow out of this introductory vision and are to be seen as the historical consequences of divine sovereignty in its exercise of both redemption and judgment. God and Christ are in ultimate control of all the woes of both believers and unbelievers. And the ultimate purpose of these woes are to refine the faith of believers and to punish unbelievers. Chapter 6, verses 1 through 8, tell of an effect of Christ's death and resurrection, that he transformed the suffering of the cross into a triumph, that he gained sovereignty over the powers of evil who had crucified him, and subsequently uses them to achieve his purposes of refining his people and punishing those who are recalcitrant in their weakness, in their wickedness, That's the focus on the throne. Number three, another key idea, key theme, is that of the new creation. Flip over to chapter 21 for an example of this. "Then I saw a new heaven and a new earth. For the first heaven and the first earth had passed away, and the sea was no more. And I saw the holy city, New Jerusalem, coming down out of heaven from God, prepared as a bride adorned for her husband. And I heard a loud voice from the throne saying, 'Behold, the dwelling place of God is with man. He will dwell with them, and they will be his people. And God himself will be with them as their God. He will wipe away every tear from their eyes, and death shall be no more. Neither shall there be mourning, nor crying, nor pain anymore, for the former things have passed away.' And he who was seated in the throne said, 'Behold, I am making all things new.' Also he said, 'Write these things down, for these words are trustworthy and true.' And he said to me, 'It is done. I am the Alpha and the Omega, the beginning and the end. To the thirsty I will give from the spring of the water of life without payment. The one who conquers will have this heritage, and I will be his God, and he will be my son." The portrayal of the new covenant, the new temple, the new Israel, New Jerusalem, these all affirm the future fulfillment of the main prophetic themes of both Old and New Testaments, which all find their ultimate climax here in the new creation. The new creation itself is one of the most overarching of these biblical promises, which the preceding four new realities are but facets. And I don't know if you caught it in chapter 21, but I like to view this, I'll call it this tripartite formula of "I will be your God, you will be my people, and I will dwell with you," as perhaps the clearest connecting thread from the very beginning of the Bible with the original creation, through what was lost in the fall, through what is beginning to be restored in the different covenants, obviously in the New Testament with the death and resurrection of Jesus, in Pentecost with the birth of the church, all the way up here to the end of Revelation. It's this one master theme that we see unfolding throughout it all, and is clearly important to John, and is clearly in the forefront of his mind in this book as well. John's repeated allusions to the Old Testament historical form of these five promises, which is all these new things, covenant, temple, Israel, Jerusalem, creation, These express a typological interpretation of history that views Old Testament institutions and realities as prophetic foreshadowings of escalated New Testament equivalent realities. For example, creation. The Exodus as fulfillment of divine covenant and as new creation. The tabernacle, Solomon's temple, the old Jerusalem. All of these things are used typologically to point to the new. These typological and prophetic themes suggest a belief in God as the sovereign designer of all history, which is planned to result in his glory. All five of these central biblical ideas, new covenant, new temple, new Israel, new Jerusalem, and new creation, are metaphors for the one reality of God's intimate, glorious presence with his people. It's apparent, though, that these prophecies had already begun to be fulfilled then in the later part of the first century. But the concluding visions about the new creation in chapters 21 and 22, even those aren't the whole main point of the book. They appear near the conclusion to underscore the basis for John's final purpose in writing, which is to encourage and admonish Christians to remain faithful. The vision of the future perfected people of God in unending fellowship with his glorious presence is intended to encourage and motivate the readers to persevere through temptation, temptations that would otherwise lead them into compromise. The prospect of final victory should provide an impetus to win partial victory now by not compromising. In other places, the bride is contrasted with the prostitute. Look at from chapter 17 all the way through 22. And it's done primarily to encourage and admonish the faltering churches troubled by compromise with the prostitute to stop compromising and reflect in greater measure the aspects of their coming consummated excellence now in anticipation of it. This intention is suggested by the fact that the imperfections of the churches named back in chapters 2 and 3 have an antithetical correspondence with the perfections named in chapters 21 and 22. Very interesting contrast. The new creation, important. Another related theme is our fourth one, which is the place of Christians in the world. You can look over to chapter 13 as an example of this. We'll start in verse 5. And the beast was given a mouth, uttering haughty and blasphemous words, and it was allowed to exercise authority for 42 months. It opened its mouth to utter blasphemies against God, blaspheming his name and his dwelling, that is, those who dwell in heaven. Also, it was allowed to make war on the saints and to conquer them. And authority was given it over every tribe and people and language and nation, and all who dwell on earth will worship it, everyone whose name has not been written before the foundation of the world in the book of life of the Lamb who is slain. If anyone has an ear, let him hear. If anyone is to be taken captive, to captivity he goes. If anyone is to be slain with the sword, with the slain must he be slain. Here is a call for the endurance and faith of the saints. Remember our purpose statement from last time, which was, the sovereignty of God in Christ in redeeming and judging brings them glory, which is intended to motivate saints to worship God and reflect his glorious attributes through obedience to his word. That's what the book's about. The book portrays an end-time new creation that is broken into the present old world through the death and resurrection of Christ, and through the sending of the Spirit at Pentecost. John's vision communicates values that run counter to the values of this old world and provide a structure of meaning that grounds the lives of Christians in the new world. Part of the main point is to motivate the readers not to compromise with the world, but align their thoughts and behaviors with the God-centered standards of the new creation. They are to see their own situation in this world in the light of the eternal perspective of the new world, which is now their true home. Continued reading of Revelation will encourage genuine saints to realize that what they believe is not strange and odd, but truly normal from God's perspective. They will not be discouraged by outside worldliness, including that worldliness that has crept into the church, which is always making godly standards appear odd and sinful values seem normal. John refers to true unbelievers as earth dwellers, because their ultimate home is this transient earth. They cannot trust in anything except what their eyes see and their physical senses perceive, and they will perish with this old order at the end of time when the corrupted cosmos is finally judged and passes away. On the other hand, Christians are like pilgrims passing through this world. As such, they are to commit themselves to the revelation of God in the new order so as to progressively reflect and imitate his image and increasingly live according to the values of the new world. They are not to be conformed to the fallen systems, its idolatrous images and associated values. One reason for the presence of so many angels in the book of Revelation, and angels, you must understand, can be interpreted as messengers or representative, right? We don't think of Cupid and little fat babies. One reason there's so many angels in Revelation throughout the visions, and especially for addressing the churches through their representative angels, is to remind Christians that a dimension of their existence is already in the heavenly realm, and that they have help and protection in their struggle not to be conformed to this world. And one purpose of the church gathering on earth every week is to be reminded of its heavenly identity by modeling its worship on the angels and the heavenly church's worship of the exalted Lamb. This is why scenes of heavenly liturgy are woven throughout the book, especially in concluding sections, which serve as interpretations of the preceding visionary narratives. It's in this manner that the churches are to learn how to worship in their gathered meetings and are to be given a zeal for the worship of the true God. The intended consequence is that believers experience an increasing attitude of worshipful reverence for God, not only in church assemblies, but in bowing to divine sovereignty in every aspect of their lives and in every facet of its outworking. Let's go back and talk about symbols again. This is where we'll end. We've covered much of this when we discussed symbolism, if you can recall that, but it is worth bringing up again since it's such an important part of the book. Throughout the Bible, the literary form of symbolic parable appears wherever ordinary warnings are no longer heeded. Remember talking about this before? And no warning will ever be heeded by people who are spiritually callous and intent on continuing in disobedience. The parabolic aspect of the Old Testament prophet's message is one of the means by which such people are to be blinded. Flip over to Isaiah chapter 6 as an example of this. Isaiah 6, 8 through 10, or how about 9 through 10, he said, "Go and say to this people, keep on hearing, but do not understand. Keep on seeing, but do not perceive. Make the heart of this people dull and their ears heavy and blind their eyes, lest they see with their eyes and hear with their ears and understand with their hearts and turn and be healed." This hardening was a key part of this parabolic message. Yet the parables are also intended to have a jolting effect on the remnant who have become complacent among the compromising majority. And a remnant of pseudo-believers are thus to be awakened and generally converted. Same message has two purposes. Parables function in the same manner all over the book of Ezekiel and in Jesus' ministry. Why did he tell so many parables? Same reason. Therefore, the appearance of parables in redemptive history signals judgment on the majority of the covenant community. Against this Old Testament and gospel background, John's repeated use of the hearing formula, which is, we read it once earlier, you know, one who has ears, let him hear, that thing. That's not novel, but that's in line with the prior prophetic pattern. As with the Old Testament and Jesus, the expression indicates that parabolic communication is intended both to open the eyes of the true remnant and to blind counterfeit members of the covenant community. It will reveal truth to some, but conceal it from others. And John addresses this formula to the church, which is the continuation of true Israel, the true covenant community. But the church, like Israel, has become spiritually dull and has begun to compromise by associating with idolatry. In Revelation, many in the churches have become intractable in their compromising stance. And the symbols in Revelation have both a hardening effect on the unbelieving and a shock effect on the genuine saints caught up in the church's compromising complacency. The symbols reveal, for example, the terrible satanic essence of the idolatrous institutions with which God's true people are beginning to participate. It opens it up clearly as to what they are. The goal is that they realize the horrific nature of these institutions and immediately break off any association with them. The hearing formula at the end of each letter to the churches in chapters 2 and 3 anticipates the visionary parables in chapters 4 through 21, and a similar formula also appears in 13:9. This is a further hint that John intends the symbolic visions of chapters 4 through 21 to have this dual revelatory function, to open the eyes of some and to blind others. This means that the symbolic visions are parabolic portrayals of the more abstractly expressed material in chapters 2 to 3. The letters broadly interpret the symbolic visions and vice versa. It's all tied together. The twofold spiritual function of the symbols is supported further by the fact that John has patterned the series of trumpets and bowls after the Exodus plague signs, which in themselves function both to harden the Egyptians and to give insight and redemption to Israel. But a remnant among the Egyptians responded positively to the plagues and left Egypt with Israel. And the majority of Israelites who left Egypt were characterized by unbelief. Look quickly at Psalm 95. This is interesting. Let's start in verse 7. For he is our God, and we are the people of his pasture and the sheep of his hand. Today, if you hear his voice, do not harden your hearts as at Meribah. On the day at Massah in the wilderness, when your fathers put me to the test and put me to the proof, though they had seen my work, for 40 years I loathed that generation and said, they are a people who go astray in their heart, and they have not known my ways. Therefore I swore in my wrath, they shall not enter my rest. These were the people that came out of Egypt, the ones who saw the plagues. The vast majority of them never inherited the promised land. As with the Old Testament prophets and Jesus, the symbols used by John in Revelation not only harden the reprobate, but they both jolt genuine believers out of their spiritual amnesia, and they shock a remnant among the unbelieving mass to believe. John applies this Exodus model to the church and to the world. Therefore, the great extent of symbolic material in Revelation is due primarily to John's theological intent to identify his relation to the situation of the Asia Minor churches, you know, who he was writing to, with the relation of the Old Testament prophets and Jesus to the plight of Israel. He was sounding a prophetic note. Summing it all up, the book of Revelation is not merely a futurology, but it's a redemptive historical and theological psychology for the church's thinking. It's to equip the saints then that received it to resist the compromise to the world, and it continues to serve that function today, or at least ought to. So to that end, it's encouraging that you all stuck with me for this long and dealt with this, because this is an important book. It's not as mysterious as it might seem on the surface, but has a real important purpose behind it. So I encourage you, if you have questions, get them to me today, and we'll deal with them next time. Thanks.